Well, good evening, and thanks for tuning in to Hemispheres. I'm your host, Jim Nelson, and thanks for tuning in to listener-supported community radio, KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins, and at kgnu.org. This evening on Hemispheres, we continue the Middle East dialogues, and as always, joining me in those dialogues are Ibrahim Kazrouni and Rob Prince. Ibrahim Kazrouni is a regular contributor to the International Press Roundtable, as many listeners know. Ibrahim also has a PhD from the joint ILIF and Denver University PhD programs within religion and social change. And Ibrahim is also Imam of the Islamic Center of America, which is in Dearborn, Michigan. And good evening to you, Ibrahim.
Good evening, Jim. Good evening, Rob. And good evening to our listeners and audience.
And also joining by phone is Rob Prince. Rob is retired senior lecturer of international studies at the Corbell School at Denver University. And Rob is also published in many online magazines, such as Foreign Policy in Focus. Rob is also a regular commentator on the online publication AlgeriaWatch.org, and he also contributes to the award-winning online publication Nahwat.org, a Tunisian human rights publication. So good evening to you as well, Rob.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Ibrahim in Detroit, and hello, listeners, wherever you might be.
Well, we'll get started right away. Tonight's program is going to be looking at the Biden administration. It does appear that Biden is officially...
Well, actually, your last point, the more things change, the more they remain the same, is really quite apt because, you know, just to kind of put out what our hypothesis is and that what we're going to try and prove the whole program is... Look, there might be reduced tensions, and looks like there will be, and that's good, in different parts of the world because of the Biden election and the end of the Trump era. But when it comes to the Middle East, we don't really see a shift in U.S. policy at all, or hardly. Some perhaps openings, but
window dressing.
We see it pretty much the same policy that we've seen. We've not only during the Trump years, but before that. And what we wanted to talk about first, Jim, before we got into the Biden Middle East appointments, which you've mentioned and which we're going to go into in much more detail, actually, we wanted to talk about this transition period a little bit. And I just want to remind the listeners, those that were listening last month, that we did, I don't say we predict, that's too strong a word, but we certainly suggested that there would not be an October surprise, that the Trump administration would not initiate a war in the Middle East, in Syria or against Syria or Iran in order to, you know, get votes. And for a whole variety of reasons that we went through last time. And that seems to be true. But, you know, now we're in November, and the question is, will there be a November surprise or a kind of evil Christmas gift? It's a very uncertain period. And one of the things that marks this period is the Trump administration's attempt to wreck on a whole number of levels, both domestic and foreign, or to make very, very difficult, if you like, some of Biden's potential programs. And certainly in the Middle East, what we're talking about, you know, there wasn't really much good that has come in these last years. But one thing was the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or commonly known as the Iran nuclear deal. So this is a really weird moment. With great uncertainty, and I don't know, you know, from the Detroit area where Ibrahim is, or from Denver, that we can, you know, this predict clearly what's going to happen. Is a very dangerous moment filled with uncertainty, and we've referred to Trump's his posture in the past, and what we call it is the wounded beast syndrome, i.e., before he goes out, will he take as many, quote, folks with him along the way? So we're looking at that, and coming, if you like, closer to home, there have been a couple of things that are worth looking into in some detail. One is Trump announced that there would be troop withdrawals, and those withdrawals would be from Iraq, Afghanistan, and Somalia. So we want to look at that a bit. And the other thing that we've noticed is at this moment, Secretary of State Pompeo is in the Middle East, and there's talks confirmed by the Israelis, denied by the Saudis, of a meeting in the western region of Saudi Arabia between Pompeo, Netanyahu, and Bin Salman of Saudi Arabia, Prince Bin Salman, which I refer to as the unholy trinity. What are they doing? What plans are they hatching between now and the end of the Trump years? One kind of general comment, just to, you know, to put this all in context about the Trump presidency, and again, just sticking to the Middle East, where it concerns the Middle East, any objective analysis of the Trump administration's Middle East politics is that it was a monumental failure. I could go through, we have gone through in other programs the details of this, wherever he was, let's just say wherever the Trump administration struck, it did not bring peace, but destabilization, war, assassination, and quite frankly, after 4 years, a rather dramatic reduction in U.S. influence throughout the region. So there's that part of it. Looking at the troop withdrawal, you know, we hear, wow, this sounds really good. Trump's leaving. He's going to withdraw troops again from these three countries. What's wrong with that?
Hey, Rob.
I mean, it sounds so good.
I just wanted to chime in. Biden did say today that the U.S. is back. So even as you mentioned, I'm not sure many
so
countries are extremely happy about that.
Blinken has made a clear statement that U.S. troops will not be withdrawn from Syria or Iraq. So he said that during the campaign. He said it in the spring. He said it in the summer. This is before he was nominated. So it's quite clear that this notion, at least from their perspective, that the troop withdrawal is not very serious. Ibrahim, let me ask you, what do you think of this announcement? It's is it too good to be true that the United States is withdrawing its troops or some of its troops from the Middle East? Could you talk about that, and could you then also talk a little bit about your take on what is Pompeo doing in Saudi Arabia with Netanyahu and Bin Salman? Okay?
Well, being a cynical person when it comes to American foreign policy, particularly during the past 4 years, I would have no other alternative but to state that it is too good to be true, because we have heard this statement during the past years, 2018, 2014, 2009, 2005, from various presidents, that we are going to withdraw troops from Middle East from one theater or the other, only to be to find out later on, say a month or 2 months or 6 months later, that not only the troops were not withdrawn, they were redeployed from one place to another, and then quietly a few thousand more were added to them and brought back to the same place. So this happened in Baghdad, in Afghanistan, in Syria, and in other places. So I have to take the whole statement of troop withdrawal with a pinch of salt, because If we were to, rather than sentimentally, immediately throw our hand in the air and say, hallelujah, yes, it's going to happen, finally, peace and tranquility, nothing of the sort. Because we have to contextualize these statements within some broader concept that I don't believe either Trump or, as you indicated, Biden or anybody else are going to forsake or renounce. And that is the what we call American imperialism and the desire to dictate and control the world. I want to take everyone back to 1992. There was a statement, the doctrine of all U.S. that became literally the spelling out the doctrine of all U.S. President, the defense planning guidelines for 1994 to 1999. It was dated February 18, 1992, by Paul Wolfowitz and Scooter Libby. And in that statement, if you look at the first, or at least the first paragraph when it comes to superpower status, our first objective is to prevent the reemergence of a new rival, neither on the territory of the former Soviet Union or elsewhere, that possesses a threat on the order that posed formerly by the Soviet Union. This is a dominant consideration underlying the new regional defense strategy and requires that we endeavor to prevent any hostile power from dominating regions whose resources would, consolidated control, be sufficient to generate the global power. If you remember at that time, when this became clear, Senator Edward Kennedy called it the 21st century American imperialism that no other country should accept. So that superpower status has been the essence and the crunch of all the doctrine, president's doctrine, starting from Wilson before and up to now. And I don't believe that statement has been rejected or renounced by Trump, or is going to be renounced by Biden. It's going to be the same thing.
But Ibrahim, but it had to have been revised somewhat updated, because the essence of that policy has failed, and now yes, we do have a competitor with the United States. It's not on the same level. But exactly what the United States was hoping to avoid or deny has emerged with the emergence of China.
And Russia.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. So I'm aware of it, but I'm just trying to say that when we come to statements being made, whether it's troop withdrawal or anything else, we have to contextualize and understand the fabric that is woven together to make American foreign policy. United States, under no circumstance, is going to renounce that kind of supremacy that it wants to have over the world. So that's number one.
Before you go on, another point here, I want a question for you. Where do organizations like Blackwater, these American mercenary quote, security organizations, fit into this picture?
I'll come to it in a minute. Number two, a little report in 2010 by CIA, it's called Red Cell Memorandum. If you check it up, Red Cell Memorandum was in response to the uprising in Holland against the government's participation in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and ultimately forcing the government to withdraw from it. So CIA comes up with, in essence, what Chomsky once said, engineering consent or manufacturing consent, to come up with some kind of titles that if you were to use them, it creates the apathy within the public that would be enough to ignore the voters' deep-hearted opinion regarding what's going on in the world. And I believe we really need to contextualize these troop withdrawal as nothing more of creating the public apathy, that then you can use it to disregard voter dislike or criticism of what's going on. If you were to tell them that we are going to increase our numbers in Iraq or somewhere else, or in Syria or something, at least these guys that Biden is appointing, they have been instrumental. By the way, this guy that we are talking about, Blinken, was major proponent of U.S. military intervention in Libya, Syria, yes. and Yemen. And he also pushed a hard line towards Russia and China. And now you are telling me that these are the major crisis points, and the poachers are becoming the gamekeepers overnight? It's not going to happen. So then we have to ask ourselves, what is so special about then suddenly this idea of the withdrawal from the message about withdrawal from Iraq, etc.? There is a debate within the academia regarding, abstract as it may be, regarding fifth-generation warfare. Fifth-generation warfare, they say that warfare evolve over generation and from one generation into another, from strategy, administrative organization, weapon, battle space, logistics, science, etc., etc. And now they are talking about a fourth and fifth generation warfare. What is so unique about fourth and fifth generation warfare is that warfare by proxy, where it becomes too expensive for the old style of warfare, that you have to have the boot on the ground with all the weapons and everything else, and leaving yourself open into constant attack by the opponent and suffering of your troops and everything else, and at the end of the day, causing huge amount of repercussion or reaction within your country when body bags begin coming home, you have no alternative but to start changing the policy one way or the other. So now what has happened in the fifth generation or fourth generation in Syria, in Iraq? First of all, I would like to add this statement. No matter, we have learned during the past 20 or so years that no matter what policy statement presidents or their administrations make regarding a particular war, ultimately, what dictates the success or the failure of the project is the situation or the fact on the ground. And starting from before, but at least we can talk about Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Ethiopia, whatever. The facts on the ground, time has been in the favor of those that are living and working on the ground. We saw this in 2006, the conflict between the Israelis and Lebanese. We saw that in other parts in Iraq, and the tapping of one senator that we want to stay in Iraq for 100 years. So long as people are rising up and prepared to really challenge the authority and the established power of the colonial power or the imperialist power, it's a matter of time before they pack and go. Taliban said that in Afghanistan, time is in our favor. So it's not what statements we hear from one administration to the other or one secretary of state to the other. Once the plan A is unpacks itself, is the reaction. I remember once Ahmadinejad was in president of Iran, and he was asked when he attended United Nations conference in New York, do you think that United States can start the war and bomb Iran? He said, sir, you're sure for the time being they can start, but we will finish it. So this is a clear understanding that over the time, whether it was Korea, whether it was Vietnam, whether it was Cambodia, whether it was anywhere else, at the end of the day, colonial powers, imperial powers were defeated. no matter how long it takes, and ultimately they have to pack up and go. So this troop withdrawal, once we contextualize it, I see it as nothing but placation of the public and generating the public apathy that you can use it to enable leaders to ignore voters' point of view.
I just want to jump in real quick, and we're coming up on 6:30, the bottom of the hour, and remind the listeners this is Hemispheres, and this is the Middle East Dialogues. We're listening right now to Ibrahim Kazrouni. We also have Rob Prince on the line, and I'm your host, Jim Nelson, for this evening's Hemispheres. And I just needed to make that little quick update. So go ahead. I'm sorry, Ibrahim, go ahead.
Yeah. And then what we have here, the privatization. Every time you have a comment or a statement coming out of Washington or a member of the administration regarding the troop withdrawal, the head of Blackwater it appears as an alternative source. We saw this in the case of Iraq. As an alternative source or alternative resources that are going to be used, and in this case being financed by the Gulf states, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others, but on the one hand, exonerates the administration that, yes, we honored our commitment and we withdrew 500 people from Syria or from Iraq. And then what happened? Replaced them with 10,000 Blackwater mercenaries. So these days, United States, because it understands it cannot confront Iran as a power in the region. Iran made it clear a couple of years ago when they shut down the biggest kind of a drone that United States was creme de la creme of U.S. Kind of drones, shut it down very easily, and they were able to distinguish between that unmanned and the manned plane that Trump thanked them for not shooting the other one that carried about 35 or 37 American servicemen in it. Iran has made it clear that it has the power, it has the technology, and it has the will to use the weapon to defend itself. Recently, you are right, Rob, in every, the failure of U.S. Foreign policy, or at least Middle Eastern policy, is quite clear when you compare it to Wolfowitz's statement at the time. They were trying in 1992 to prevent any of these superpowers or semi-superpowers to be able to challenge the United States. And the presence of Russia, the Chinese, probably the Indians and others in the region, is clear statement that 1992 policy of dominating the world has failed. And since United States has no plan B, you have no other option but to bring in expression you use, re-thread politicians that come out of Obama.
Obama retreads, yes.
Retread politicians.
We'll talk about that in a minute. Right.
Yeah. So I don't believe that one could trust this administration and take these statements seriously because we have heard them many times before. But I believe there is a sinister reason behind it. It is said to placate the society and the voters to become apathetic to the situation. That's it. We have achieved our goal. Mm-hmm. Troops are withdrawn and peace is coming.
I'm going to be optimistic and just to say that since we have John Kerry in the cabinet, even though he's going to be mm-hmm. dealing with climate change, the environment,
yeah,
and it's a cabinet post, but he is one of the major brokers of the JCPOA, and we probably will see an attempt to bring that back or to rejoin mm-hmm. that issue. And then we also have probably the INF treaty that might be brought back. I'm not sure if the Russians want to come back to that. And the open skies is being thrown out, but we probably will go back to that. And then the New START treaty. Some things I see it as a positive.
Can I interject here?
Yeah.
I think all of these kind of treaties that you mentioned, they are secondary to the crisis that is happening in the Middle East.
Correct.
What is happening in the Middle East, that's what become the litmus test that would decide whether the direction of one administration or the other. I made it clear when we had another program last month with Rob.
Yeah.
I said the incumbent administration should be judged by the deed that it has done, not by promises that it makes. That applies to both Trump and Biden. When you select or appoint number of people that in the previous administration, they have never worked for peace, whether in the Middle East or anywhere else, but worked for conflict, and they are strong adherers. Again, we're going back to the Wolfowitz statement. In the Middle East, our overall objective is to remain the predominant outside power in the region and preserve U.S. and Western access to the regional oil.
Yeah, and I was just going to say that I was going to wrap that, my little optimistic commentary, as this will be window dressing to distract the detractors in some respects and keep us away from, like you're saying, Ibrahim, we should be focused on the Middle East. Yeah, go ahead.
I want to jump in here and
say a couple things.
Rob, hold on, Ibrahim, because I want to add something to this. It's not clear in terms of global policy where the United States is heading. You know, for a moment, let's forget the Middle East for one second. I'll tell you how it looks to me. It looks to me like what we're going to see is a replay of the Kissinger-Nixon attempt to woo China. So the United States will negotiate with China, I believe, in a Biden presidency, mostly in an attempt to kind of weaken the alliance between China and Russia, which is really at the heart of the opposition to U.S. global hegemony. Now, on that score, the Biden administration might produce some positive developments. All right. My main concern is when I look at what's going on in the Middle East and these appointments, which we'll talk about in the rest of the hour, that the changes in policy, as you expressed it, basically the continued American military, political, overall dominance of the region, that continues, that's the strategic goal, and that's what they hope to accomplish. And in fact, to a certain degree, I mean, you know, Trump was not that interested in the Middle East. You know, he wants to deal with
what he
considers to be the big players. But
and you can support your argument by the fact that foreign policy was absent from the election.
That's right. It was completely. It was not part of the primaries or of the presidential debate at all, or hardly. A few statements here and there. But there are a couple things that I want to do before looking at what I see as one possible positive light in an otherwise dark picture in terms of Biden's Middle East policy, and that is the possibility of returning to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit, because several people have asked me about it, including Jim, about this Pompeo visit, and that won't take that long. So Pompeo at this moment, he goes to Israel. What does he do in Israel? He visits the Golan Heights. He visits the West Bank. And basically what he's doing is very provocative. He's basically making it more difficult for Biden to undo making Jerusalem the capital. He's basically de facto saying that Golan Heights are no longer occupied territory. They're Israeli. Same with the West Bank. So it's just kind of a provocation, if you like. And who is provoking is Biden, not to change those policies. And I'm more concerned about this meeting in Saudi Arabia. And here, I want to admit, I don't know exactly, needless to say, what's going on. But the little that comes out is it's once again this anti-Iranian front. United States, Saudi Arabia, Israel. One possibility, and here I'm just speculating, and I hope it doesn't come to be, is that Pompeo is there to encourage the Israelis and or the Saudis some kind of military attack on Iran before Biden comes to power, which would have a number of consequences, but the main one being moving towards the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear deal impossible. All right, throwing that monkey wrench out. Now, I want to insist upon the fact that I don't know that this is what's going on, but I'm very suspicious of what's happening there, and I have a feeling that whatever they're cooking up there, we're gonna hear about it and see about it sometime before January 20th, and we all have to be very careful,
Rob,
and try to prevent that. Do you see that? Is that just paranoia, Ibrahim?
Yeah.
Or do you think there's something to it?
Yeah, there are two views regarding whether the Netanyahu, Mohammed bin Salman, and Pompeo visit did actually take place or not. There is
a view that says
it did take place, and the news should have been kept secret, but it was somehow leaked out. The other one is that it's a preemptive way of leaking the news out so that the rejection or the anti-Saudi sentiment settles down that, well, it's happened, Netanyahu goes over there. But Your conclusion is correct, that United States is trying to build again, reassure the alliance and build an alliance against Iran. And Iranians responded very quickly to this by during the visit, the so-called G20 meeting, the Houthis fired at least two or three drones into
the Yemeni Houthis.
From Yemen, fired two or three missiles directly into the Aramco platform near Jeddah city in Arabian Peninsula, giving a warning that we have all part of Saudi Arabia covered. There was strange for me to read Wahhabi political commentators reminding the government that they are ill-advised to get involved in this war on confrontation, because if Iranians unleashed their weapon, this was expression that they used, we are going to the 10th age in the desert.
Oh my gosh.
This is from a seriously accepted political commentator in Saudi Arabia that normally do not make such a comment. So they were afraid that if this, on the one hand, the Houthis fire, on which is seriously, and immediately Netanyahu in Tel Aviv said that this is very serious because they only need to add few kilometers or few miles to the range of these missiles and they can hit Tel Aviv.
Yeah, and there was something else, Ibrahim, that it's along the same lines of some kind of, this hybrid warfare, political warfare. But it was an article that appeared in the New York Times on the 16th of November. And I found it quite an extraordinary article because it supposedly revealed a discussion in the White House where Trump wanted to use the equivalent of a nuclear weapon, you know, these very powerful conventional bombs that they have, to blow up the Natanz nuclear plant in Iran. And that, you know, the way that the article, the spin of the article was that his generals, I can't remember all of the details, but there was opposition from his generals. Apparently, Pompeo smiled and thought this might, you know, here we come. Here's the rapture's coming. But in the end, he backed off. But then it becomes a major story in the U.S. media. And, of course, it's picked up in Iran. Then there's this meeting in Saudi Arabia, whatever. But the message is the same. We're after Iran. We're going to get Iran one way or another, whether it's the United States bombing it, whether it's some collusion between the Saudis and the Israelis. And the sense one gets is, once again, this attempt to provoke Iran. It's another kind of provocation. We're after you. We're going to get you all the same. What's your reading on that?
I don't believe that this is going to happen, because Israelis know, Saudi Arabia as well, I mean, Saudis as well as the Americans know, that Iran is going to respond. That's why the generals and even Pence, the vice president, tried to persuade him not to even think about
all
it,
right,
because it's a
all
different
right, so,
equation that you're getting into.
I've got another question for you, because now I'm concerned about the time.
Before you go, I have a question for you.
Okay, you have a question for me. Go on.
Yes. Number one, I'm going to, since we started, Jim posed the question regarding Biden's foreign policy.
Right.
I want to see if, in the light of what we have read so far about these individuals, they're all crooks and associated with one military industry or the other. So how do you see Biden is going to lead his Middle Eastern policy? And in the light of, we saw Obama committing so many mistakes, call it mistake or whatever, foreign policy blunders that led us to the crisis, whether it's Syria or Yemen or anywhere else. Where do you think Biden is going to go? He has a little bit more international experience, Middle Eastern experience, than even Trump.
What do you think? How can we evaluate Biden Middle East policy is going to be? Well, there have been a couple of statements that he's made. He has referred, when foreign policy has come up those few times, of wanting to reinstitute, for the United States to return to the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. There's that. He's really hardly the main thing that he has stated, you know, over and over again, is his support for, love for, defense of Israel. And so this policy of the U.S. unconditional political, economic, every way support of Israel, that's going to continue, and that's going to be the center. That's going to be the center of Biden's Middle East policy. That's pretty easy to predict. For the rest, you know, we look at these advisors that Jim was talking about early on, and I find it amusing and typical. They're highly respected in the New York Times and the Washington Post. That is to say, within this really kind of tiny circle of the Beltway, where everyone, you know, first of all, they know each other, and they all, you know, care for each other and all that kind of stuff. They and socialize with one another, that kind of thing. And what you see there is this continual interaction between the government, the military, the military-industrial complex, and they're just kind of musical chairs where they're coming from. So this is true of Blinken. This is true of Michelle Fortney. This is true. What's her name? April Hale. When you look at their policies more carefully,
Jack Sullivan.
What? And yes, and Sullivan. But really, they're all on the same track when it comes to the Middle East. They're all for regime change. They're all for a very strong use of sanctions, the way they've been used. Every single one of these names that have come up and others were strong advocates of the overthrow of the Gaddafi government in Libya. And in fact, I was just reading.
Well, and Blinken was for regime change and going back to Syria and Assad.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, that's definitely and just like you said, in Libya as well.
Jim, I was just reading about Blinken. Blinken was one of the architects of calling for a de facto partition of Iraq. So when we look at who are the architects, if you like, of U.S. policy in Iraq and Libya and what they tried to do in Syria and regime change in Iran, this is the team. This is the team. And add to it. These are the ones that have made us accustomed to and to accept the murder of foreign dignitaries, assassination by drone. These are the ones that support the Syrian mercenaries and you know, call them whatever it is, moderate opposition. So they're a real team, and they have been around for a decade. And if you study their record, right, if this is the team, what does that say to us, number one, about how U.S. policy in Syria is going to change? Well, and other statements, particularly that Blinken has made. And my sense is, if we're going by their statements, the situation in Syria is going to get worse. There's going to be more U.S. troops there and, you know, more underhanded actions and more stealing of Syrian oil and burning of their wheat fields and more sanctions. So this is their record. Now, my friends, I don't mean to, give this dark picture. It's nice that we're very pleased that Trump isn't there. But these are the facts about Biden's appointment. These are the people that will monitor and direct U.S. Middle East policy, along with, and I don't know how they're going to fit in, but this whole coterie that includes Madeleine Albright, Hillary Clinton, Susan Rice, Samantha Powers, the humanitarian interventionists who are interventionists but not very humanitarian in the end. That's the team. And when we look at that team, you know, all we can do at this point and look at their record. Well, are they going to change and become pacifists?
Even Henry Kissinger yeah. has made some comments for Biden.
Kissinger connection has to do with how he should deal with Russia and China.
Right, exactly.
That's really the heart of that. And it's kind of this old Metternich, the Austrian diplomat.
Right.
And basically, it's real simple. You negotiate with big powers, i.e. particularly China in this case, China and Russia a little bit. And then you give the hard line, the hawkish policy to everybody else. You dictate policy to all the others. You would dictate policy to China too, but you can't. It doesn't work. So that's the Kissinger contribution, if you like, to all this. And their goal there is divide and conquer. It's to divide China from Russia. What?
In the light of what you have just painted as far as U.S. Middle Eastern policy, within this context, is it safe to assume that forget about 2015 agreement with Iran, seriously going back to it? Because I remember even after signing it, Obama was the one did not adhere to various chapters and articles of the 2015 and began by imposing sanctions. So is there any hope because yesterday, or is it today, Khamenei delivered a speech in Iran, and he said, we have exactly what we have been trying to say during the past hour or so. that we know all of these individuals, and their shelf dates, sell-by dates have been finished because they have shown their hands. We've tried to negotiate and resolve our issues through negotiation, and we failed, even during Obama. So I don't see, this was his word, I don't see any change in, I don't see Biden being able to deliver anything that Obama was not able to do.
Well,
so what do you think?
And I'll just add that maybe the some of the meeting, if this meeting actually did occur, like we're saying, it's been reported that Pompeo met with these individuals, but it could be also, you know, coming up with some idea on how to resist rejoining the Iran nuclear deal, if the U.S. moves in that direction, you know?
What you have to keep in mind, first of all, I wouldn't say that I am optimistic that that the United States will rejoin the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. And let's just remind people, because it gets lost when it's referred to as the Iran nuclear deal. Somehow you think of it as something just between the United States and Iran.
This is true.
There were, you know, the five plus one, right?
Exactly.
Not only that, but this was it plus two? Okay, plus two. This went through. This agreement was accepted and voted on in a favorable way by the UN Security Council. So we are talking about a multinational agreement. Okay, part of that agreement, the essence of the agreement, it's very long and complicated, but if you wanted to boil it down, was Iran will stop developing or limit its development of nuclear material to a certain low level, i.e. not weapons-grade nuclear material, but stuff you could use for medicine, things like that, peaceful uses. And in exchange, the United States would lift sanctions. Okay, the Iranians
and Europeans.
The United States and the Europeans would lift sanctions. What did the United States do? It not only did it not lift sanctions, it increased them almost immediately. So you know what I'm hearing from some of my friends as well. If Iran can adhere to the Iran nuclear deal, maybe it could be done again. Well, the problem is it's not Iran that violated the stipulations. It was the Obama administration. So we got that. But having said that, at that moment, that was a moment of hope. That was a moment that the tensions in the Middle East might be reduced, not only between the United States and Iran, but between all the players. There was talk in the aftermath of that agreement. Well, the countries involved have to address the Israeli-Palestinian issue. They had to address Syria. So it was like a step away from war. And I think that I know that there are some people in this administration and certainly in civil society that want to see the United States return to that agreement. And in fact, there are a number of local groups, some of which might be surprised to some of you, that have been actively working on pushing the Biden administration to do that here in Colorado and nationally. And I want to name them because they deserve credit. One is the Friends Committee on National Legislation. The second is the National Iranian American Council. And the third is J Street, the Zionist group. But they have a clear position. The United States should be part of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. So
Rob,
can these groups put enough pressure and can they help the Biden administration move in the direction of the agreement? I don't know. But it would be if the Biden administration can accomplish this, it can
Rob,
return. This would be a great thing as far as I'm concerned. But will it happen?
Interject?
I don't know. What? Excuse me.
I agree with you. You can be hopeful of these leftists or more realistic groups. But unfortunately, the shortcoming of their position is they buy into the narrative that Iran is at fault.
Yes, they do. Some of them speak of the Iranian threat, and that's a shortcoming with their approach.
Yeah. But I agree.
That's in the real world. But on the other side, they're at least to my knowledge, they are among at this point the only forces that immediately, you know, even before Biden administration gets off the ground, they're saying, "Hey, this is an important agreement. We've got to be part of it again, and we have to move the Middle East in a direction of peace rather than instability and war."
I guess it's wishful thinking, but I'm pleased that it's nice to see those forces are there in our country, but not dead yet. Religious scholars here are writing letters to Biden, but without buying into that narrative that Iran is a threat. They are trying to remind Biden administration that Iran has never been a threat.
That's right. The threat has come from somewhere else, hasn't it? Yes.
Iran has somehow is a threat, either nuclear or otherwise. If there is a threat, it's the Zionist regime or the Israelis, as they have put it.
We're going to have to end it there, gentlemen. The time is running out. And I want to thank you both for a lively discussion on what will be the next 4 years, or potentially the next 4 years in a Biden administration. So I don't expect much. And we'll end it there.
Well, in the end, I agree. Yeah.
Not much change. And we'll circle back to what I said. The more things change, the more they remain the same. Good evening, gentlemen. The music tells us.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Yes, the music tells us that we've come to an end to another edition of Hemispheres. I want to thank Ibrahim Kazrouni and Rob Prince for tonight's Middle East Dialogue, a lively discussion on the incoming Biden administration and foreign policy in the Middle East. And if you would like to comment on this evening's program, you can call the comment line. It's 7 o'clock, and now time for the Cabaret program.
Live and local music program. My name is Indra, and I'll be your host for today's program. Today, I'll be speaking with Michael of the local